Fishing with John. Fishing with John.
Fishing. John Lurie has pursued his own particular artistic expression through just about every medium available for over three decades: music, painting, acting and directing, and the written word. Whether he's playing saxophone with his band, The Lounge Lizards, starring in a Jim Jarmusch movie, fishing with Dennis Hopper in Thailand, or painting works with titles like I Need to Know If There Is Life After Death and I Need to Know Kinda Soon, and You Have the Right to the Pursuit of Happiness, Good Luck with That, Mr. Lurie has epitomized a hip downtown world that may longer no longer exists, if it ever did in the first place. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, he'll be screening episodes of his cult TV show called Fishing with John. We just heard the theme song. It's at the Nighthawk Cinema in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and we're pleased that it brings John Lurie back to our show. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. Just six episodes of Fishing with John were aired in 1991. Where?
They weren't aired until 98.
Really?
It was actually a Japanese company that produced them, and then they went bankrupt in the middle, and it took a long time before we finished them. And
is that why there were only six? Were they a hit at the time?
Well, because it all took so long, and the Japanese, and then this guy, Mr. Okabe, who was the owner of that company, he really kind of sacrificed a lot to finish the shows, but it wasn't like there was any money to make more. And they were a hit. I mean, in a cult kind of way, they were, you know, they're on Netflix right now.
And you can get them on DVD, too, can't you?
Yeah, through Criterion, yeah.
So how did you come up with the idea for the show? Because it's almost like a Dadaist TV show.
I don't know. I never know how to answer that question. How did you come up with the idea? But I came home very, very late at night, or in the morning, really, and I turned on the TV, and there was nothing on except for fishing shows. And I thought, well, I want to do this. I'd always had this thing. You know, remember Mutual of Omaha, Marlon Perkins, and he would tell you what the animals were thinking? I always, since I was 10 years old, wanted to have a TV show where I would tell you what the animals were thinking. And that was the original.
And your narrator, in a very professional tone, delivers non sequiturs and misinformation throughout the show.
Well, it's Rob Webb, who you can hear on all kinds of things now. But I owe a lot to him because I could write complete nonsense, and he would say it, and it would sound true. And that really takes a great voiceover guy to do that. It would just be like
very authoritative.
I loved him. Yeah.
So, but was this? Did you like to go fishing normally?
I used to go fishing with my dad. I used to go. Yeah, and me and Willem Dafoe had been fishing. Me and Flea had been fishing. I would go fishing sometimes. But this, you know, the show was really more about that I had no idea what I was doing and everything went wrong. And the narrator would explain how brave I was to be attempting to do these things.
And you did go to some pretty extreme places, really harsh environments. And emotions run high. I'm thinking about the argument you have with Tom Waits.
Yeah, so much is made out of that. You know, Tom got, you know, he got seasick in the morning and then it was 110 degrees and we needed this shot and he got cranky and I left it in the show. Mm-hmm. And then so much. I mean, I think a normal person would have cut it out, but I thought this is what it's about.
And was Tom okay with that?
I mean, we were upset with each other for about a year after the show, and but he likes the show. I mean, he got seasick. I think he's okay with it.
Then you filmed with Dennis Hopper,
yeah,
in Thailand. What would it take for you to consider doing additional episodes? And who would you want to go fishing with now, other than me?
Well, it would
take,
I would do additional fishing shows if it was just opened up in front of me, if there was no business nonsense, if there was no jumping through hoops, if it was just like, you can host and direct these shows, even do the music, I could, but it's never like that, you know? You know, it's always difficult if it's here, do this. Because also what made this so great was it was a Japanese company who let me do everything that I wanted. There was no interference whatsoever. And who would I like to take? Well, Flea I would definitely like to go with. We're funny together. It's an odd... Roberto Benigni I would very much like to take.
You've made films with him.
Yeah, well, I was in Down by Law with him, and then I did The Little Devil, Il Piccolo Diavolo, with him. But I also just... I felt really bad when, you know, Life is Beautiful came on here. And he's a genius. If I've ever met a genius, and he's a sweet, sweet man. But he doesn't speak any English. And he would come on Letterman or Leno and act like Professor Irwin Corey, like a buffoon, because he doesn't speak English. I said, Bob, you can't do it. And he said, I don't know what else to do. I don't even understand what they're saying. And it was the only thing he could do. And then our country had this really...
That explains my interview with him. Okay.
He really doesn't speak English. I mean, you know.
Well, he doesn't understand the nuances.
No, his English is, I mean, his English is about like my Italian. And if I go on TV, I mean, they're going to translate for me. But for him, it was, oh, you don't speak English, you're an idiot. And it wasn't fair. And he kind of got stranded in that.
So Fishing with John is going to be shown at the Nighthawk Cinema in Williamsburg next Wednesday.
Saturday at midnight,
and
then
again
the
following Wednesday.
Yeah.
Did they look good on the big screen?
They look great. I mean, I was shocked. But I didn't want to do a video. You know, I don't like the way video looks, but there was this guy, John Huntington, who was the tech guy. And after the first show, all the episodes really looked good. And when they screened it, I thought, it's going to look terrible. And I went out there before, and I was like, oh, this looks beautiful. I was shocked at how good they looked.
Now, you have a kind of a friendly connection to the Nighthawk cinema. There were a couple of concerts that you were supposed to do.
No.
Okay.
Where does...
Because I seem to remember you were going to be playing there. In connection to some other things, and it got canceled.
I don't know what you're talking. You know, I haven't been able to play music. I have advanced Lyme disease, and I haven't been able to.
So it's prevented you from playing since?
Yeah, I haven't played
since. Do you feel frustrated?
I can't even think about it. It's too painful. I just don't. I block it out of my mind. I don't think about it.
So, can they ever cure Lyme disease?
Well, look, I'm like, look at me.
You look okay.
I'm like. You know, the last time I was on your show was 2006 before I got the IV antibiotics. And it was like you know, that John Coltrane line about playing with Thelonious Monk, which was like walking into a room, but there was no floor. I mean, it was kind of like that was what my existence. And last time I was here, I was just sort of holding on to the edge and trying, you know. And so I'm like a lot better than that. But if playing again, that seems unlikely.
Now, you said during that last visit here that you were working on a memoir.
Yeah.
Are you still working on it?
It's almost done. It's called What Do You Know About Music? You're Not a Lawyer. It's 94% done. But I don't know quite how to get it out there. I might just put it on my website and give it away.
Well, Richard Hell has done very nicely with his memoir. Mm.
Yeah. I know he has. And HarperCollins contacted me. And they wanted me, and then, okay, it's a go, and we'll get back to you in May. And so in July, I sent them an email saying, I looked it up. May is the month between April and June, and they didn't answer. I don't know what happened with that.
So, well, they still might be interested. Somewhere.
I don't know. If they're listening, they know how to find me.
Are you still spending most of your time painting?
Yeah, mostly I'm painting.
When did you start doing that?
Well, when I got sick, I was stuck in my house for like years. And I had painted all the time. But then in the 90s, when I got so busy with everything, it sort of slowed to nothing. And then I got really sick in 2002, and I was just stuck in there. And I started painting, but I was just really doing it for myself. And then it got better and better, and, you know, and it became serious. And actually, I never imagined this would happen. But it got to, for me, like what the music was. It really started really coming out of me, you know.
Well, there is, if you look over the history of literature and music and art, you find a lot of people who are good at more than one thing, or at least they like to do more than one thing. Do you think that art, that the artistic impulse often?
I don't think I would have been good at painting if I was doing it while I was doing music.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to really put your soul into it, and you have to kind of clean your own psyche so that it can come out that way, and your technique has to match it. There was a point when the painting got to be what the music was, but if I had just painted while I was doing music, I don't think it would have ever hit what it got to. You know what I mean?
Is there a thread that runs through your work as an actor, musician, and painter?
I'm sure there is, but I don't know how to define what that is. Well, but don't you find that most actors and stuff who paint, that it's usually awful? And most musicians, too, when you see their paintings, they go, oh, jeez, I wish they No, is that not true?
Yeah, well, there were some exceptions.
You know, a great painter is Martin Mull. I just saw a couple. I mean, I don't know if in generally, but I saw a couple of things of his. They were like, these are beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well,
what?
I'm trying to think of the great actor who was in Godot and who played in Fiddler, who was
Zero Mostel.
Yeah, Zero Mostel. He was a painter.
My brother owns a Zero Mostel self-portrait because he was a good friend of my uncle's.
And he was a painter first.
Yeah. He was a painter first?
Yeah, and then...
Yeah, but so was Hitler, you know. So.
Oh. Are you saying Zero Mostel was that bad?
No, it's got something. It's got something. No, Zero Mostel, but that he's a different kind of thing, you know.
Well, the humor seems to be something that runs through much of your work.
No, that's just people misunderstand, you know, what I'm saying, and they think it's supposed to be funny.
In August 2010, The New Yorker ran a profile of you that was quite controversial. Why do you think that it went so awry?
Boy, I really wish I knew. I really wish I knew. I had a respect for The New Yorker magazine that was instilled in me from childhood because my parents spoke so highly of the magazine. And I mean, but this was just, it was so undignified and inaccurate. And it was really cruel, really, considering the situation I was in. It was cruel that they did this like this. And I would love to sit down with them, Tad Friend, the writer, David Remnick, the editor of the magazine, in front of a camera, and discuss this article piece by piece.
But my sense is that often when people are writing about or talking to somebody who has some kind of recognition, they're really talking to the image rather than the person. And you do have this eccentric image, and maybe...
Eccentric is fine. They made me look like a hypochondriac when they absolutely knew I had Lyme disease and called it a mysterious ailment, and I have an enormous problem. And that's a really irresponsible thing to do to the whole Lyme community. And then they knew I was dealing with this very serious stalker situation and made it look like, oh, maybe it wasn't happening, and they knew it was. And that stranded me in that situation. And it was
for effect, you think?
I don't know why.
Well, your brother, Evan, wrote a letter to The New Yorker. Many other people have said that they were misquoted in the article.
Yeah.
But has it had an impact on your career?
I mean, you see an article like that. Who wants to have anything to do with that guy, you know, in that article? And it's made people shy away from me. I mean, I even felt like, who knows if that's true? You don't know. But, you know, used to be everybody returned my phone calls, and then suddenly nobody did, you know. Hey, but I didn't, my career, I don't even care that they misrepresented the disease. But what they did, do you know that, so mostly they promised me that, I said, look, I would hate this article to be about John Laurie, isn't he the man who fled from a stalker? And Tad Friend said, if I did that, I would have failed in my writing. Yeah, I mean, almost everything he promised me before I agreed to do the article, he reneged on at some point. And they left me stranded in the stalker situation, making me look hysterical. And I don't mind people thinking I'm eccentric, that I'm even crazy in that Thelonious Monk, Vincent van Gogh artist kind of way. But hypochondriac, I got Lyme disease, and hysterical, no, I got a serious problem. Last time I was announced as being on the radio was East Village Radio, and they do it in the storefront. I said, I better not do it live because I've got this situation. And so we pre-recorded it. And then at, 2 o'clock on Sunday when it was announced as being live, the guy who did the interview called me and said, oh my God, he's outside, he's looking in the window. So it creates this constant always being on the alert. And I didn't see the guy, I don't know for sure that that's what happened, but it just puts your life into this sort of spooky horror movie.
Well, luckily we're on tape right now.
And we're live, aren't we?
Oh, trying to protect you there, John.
Let's start again.
So the other thing, the nicer word that gets attached to your name is cult. You're a cult musician, a cult artist.
Is that a good cult thing?
I think it probably is, because in a way it suggests that there are people who are really devoted to
your career. What's
been
happening, which is really so sweet, is, we've got the paintings are on my website and they're on Facebook and stuff. And people, like normal people, not rich people, have started buying the paintings, like saving up their money to buy paintings. And there's something so rewarding about that. It just feels, Because they come and they look at it. And, you know, they've struggled to, you know, it wasn't some rich guy who has 50 things, you know, in his basement. It was like, they loved them that much.
Leonard Lauder is not collecting you and giving it to the Met. These are people like
people with jobs, you know. It's really, and it just feels, I can't tell you how good it feels.
Are you going to be present during the screenings of Fishing with
John? Yeah, that's the whole idea. I do a question and answer afterwards, which is, you know.
And the Nighthawk is a really fun place to go.
They're really sweet people. It's a nice theater. It's been fun to do that there. Yeah. So, I only went there to do my thing, so I saw it differently. But the chairs are comfortable. They have, you know, I mean, it's really nice there, yeah.
If you want to know more about the screenings that are taking place this Wednesday, Saturday, and then next Wednesday, you can even buy tickets, by the way. Just go to our show page at WNYC.org. And my great thanks to John Lurie for coming on our show. You came to talk about Fishing with John, but there are so many different things.
I got a lot to talk about. I was up all night thinking, like, how am I going to squeeze? Because I got a lot to say, but...
Well...
Why'd you have me back like... Like
we'll have you on
a
as a regular, John.
I could just be, you know, like your Ed McMahon.
Yeah, okay, that'd be great. Laugh at all my jokes.
Okay.
Well, Ed McMahon used to do that. Thanks again for being on our show.
Thanks, Leonard.